This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. Bonnie Holly has owned Holly's Florist in downtown Rutland for more than 37 years. And at 70, she says she'd like to retire.
The business has been for sale for about 2.5 years. I've had a lot of inquiries, and I've had some people who were very serious about wanting to purchase. But there's really limited, if any, financing for very small, what they call micro businesses.
Holly employs 4 full-time and 2 part-time employees, and she says her business has gross annual sales of between $500,000 and $700,000. She says the wedding business is huge in Rutland County, and there aren't many other full-service florists in the area. And while the recession hurt, she says her business has been growing steadily the last 3 years. That's why it's so frustrating, she says, that several serious potential buyers couldn't get financing, despite having what seemed to be considerable business experience. And while she knows national organizations like the Small Business Administration help small business owners access money and partner with lenders, Holly says their idea of small doesn't really jibe with Vermont-sized businesses.
Vermont has so many small businesses that are micro businesses. That's what we all are. I mean, even when we started, you end up starting using credit cards or something. That's not a good interest rate to start a business with. And it's not like you have a lot of resources at that time. By the time you pay for your college education and, you know, get started and pay for rent and whatever, where you're going to live, there's not big money to come and start it all on your own.
Today on Vermont Edition, small business loans, what it takes to get one, and how to improve your chances. We'll talk with lenders to find out what they're looking for when it comes to financing. And we'll explore other ways small businesses can access funding besides traditional banks. Listeners, tell us about your experiences when you tried to get a small business loan. Were you successful? Why or why not? Do you have tips you can share with us? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Joining me to talk about all of this today is Will Hamilton. He's with the Vermont Federal Credit Union, and he's a business lender. And Deborah Boudrio. She's an area business advisor for the Vermont Small Business Development Center. That's a statewide program that offers no-cost advising services to help business owners in Vermont grow, create jobs, and thrive. And thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Will Hamilton, let me start with you. At the start of the show, we heard from a Rutland florist who says she's frustrated by what she considers a lack of financing available for small businesses. Are banks and credit unions making fewer small business loans today than, say, they were 5, 10, or 20 years ago?
It's hard to say whether it's more or less. I'm really not sure what the numbers were from 5 years ago. I feel like we, as lenders in Vermont, are able to do a good job of reaching out and getting familiar with the small businesses. No two businesses are alike. No two applicants are alike. So there's a lot of things that need to be put together.
Well, what about the size of the business? Is there anything to the criticism that the small size event of many Vermont businesses make their loans too small for large financial institutions to bother with?
I think that's fair to say with the larger institutions. I think you'll find that the smaller banks, community banks, and credit unions are very well able to get with the smaller applicants and really learn about them and take the time to meet their needs.
Deborah Boudrio, as an advisor with the state's Small Business Development Center, what should business owners or prospective business owners do before they even walk into a bank or credit union to increase their chances of getting a loan?
Well, they can come and see us. That's probably the first step. The thing to do is to really understand the scope of what you're planning on doing. I take an approach, as my other advisors do. We have a 4-leg approach to whether a business can be viable and sustainable. And that's, you know, what's the idea? Is there the market for it? Do the numbers work on both a personal and a business level? And then a 4th leg, which is really important, especially in Vermont, and that is, does it fit your lifestyle? Does it fit into your, you know, to your community, to the work that you're doing, to your family? I mean, I find my Vermont businesses much very aware of what their whole surroundings are. They're not myopic people. So doing a kind of quick and fast, we call it back of the envelope, look at the numbers helps first. And then if it looks like it's a viable business, then we can start putting together the kind of complete package, a full business plan package that a bank would need. And then we can come in and help advise. We're not allowed to go to the banks with you, but we certainly know what lenders are out there, what they're doing, who's lending at what level, and how to sort of put a package together that might meet your needs. So I think part of the mistake that business owners make is in the excitement, which is always so wonderful for us to be involved in. But in that excitement, they may go to a bank too soon. They may have decided and made their decision before they've gathered all the facts. And the bank really wants you to be fully prepared when you walk in the door.
Well, Hamilton, what do you see as the biggest mistakes people make when seeking business loans?
I think a lot of people out there have really good ideas about what direction they want to take their business in. But as Deborah said, it really helps us if they're prepared with a business plan. And I wouldn't say it's a mistake for people to come and talk to us early on. But oftentimes, we will refer them back to the Small Business Development Center to fine-tune their business plan, to rethink some things, give us a clearer picture of what they're looking to do.
Deborah Boudreau, how often do people come in to you with an idea for a prospective business, or maybe they see a business that they want to purchase, and they really don't have the numbers at all? I mean, how prepared are people when they come see you?
You know, clearly we're an advising service, so our numbers are probably skewed towards people, you know, either wanting to take advantage of our service to get prepared. So I would say we skew higher to the side of people coming and they aren't fully aware. And sometimes I have to say there's a downside in having done a full business plan without talking to anybody else, because you can kind of do it in an ivory tower and not really test it in the marketplace, and you can get married to it and not be willing to shift it. And really, you know, entrepreneurs who are sustainable and successful can move on a dime, you know, see the changes in the market. So we kind of like people to be in that frame of mind where they're willing to look at a lot of options. But I would say most small businesses in Vermont didn't start with a full-fledged business plan unless they were going through the full commercial lending process, and most of them don't have one that they can just pull off the shelf.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about what it takes to get a small business loan and where Vermont businesses can go for help. My guests are Deborah Boudreau, a business advisor for the Vermont Small Business Development Center. That's a statewide program that provides free advising services to businesses in Vermont, and Will Hamilton, a business lender with the Vermont Federal Credit Union. You can join us by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition webpage at vpr.net. Our number once again is 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call now from Montpelier and talk with Ben. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well. Go ahead.
So I own a small specialty food business based in Montpelier, and I make a condiment. I actually make hot sauce for a living. And we had been working at a small commercial kitchen for about the last 5 years, and now we're at the point where we had to scale up and buy some equipment. After shopping around and trying my hands at grants a little bit, I was able to secure a small business loan from Northfield Savings Bank, actually, that has a very, very, very competitive rate. It's about 3%. Which I just wanted to share with other small business people throughout the state.
So, Ben, I have a question for you. Did you find that you also had to cobble a number of lending sources together, grant money, loan money, to come up with enough money for your project?
No, it's really been baby steps over the last 6-7 years, just accumulating money, accumulating equipment. And I was lucky enough to find a facility with another small producer which helps us both kind of save on rent. And I think a lot of small-time partnerships really, really help small business folks just working with one another to cut costs in such a way. That is
great. Well, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Well, Hamilton, when you talk to prospective borrowers who come in. What sort of advice do you have if maybe their loan application isn't quite right? Do you often assist them in tweaking it, or how do you help maybe people that are almost ready to get a loan but not quite?
Well, Nina, there's a few things that lenders will be able to do as far as telling them what we can offer and how we can help them and what kind of financing programs are available. What we try to avoid is coaching them in how to run their business. That's really not what a lender wants to do. There are liability issues with that, but more importantly, we need to know that the applicant is going to be able to take that business up off the ground. Deborah with the Small Business Development Center, you guys do a tremendous job in helping people really ask the questions that need to be asked as far as what products they're going to deal with, where their location is going to be.
So, Nina, I think that's a great point. One of the things that we do with our clients is, and in addition to our advising being no cost, it's also confidential. So people can feel really okay about talking to us about anything. But one of the first things I will ask if someone comes in and they've been refused at a bank is why? What did they say to you? And often when we get refused, we don't take that pause and take a breath and then ask why. And so we talk to our clients a lot about that. The question that you ask after no is why. So if I can find out from a bank, someone like Will, exactly why the loan was refused, then I can work with the client to address some of those issues. And that's always a process. And sometimes it's just a matter of finding a different partner, addressing, you know, for small business owners, one of the things you really have to understand in your entire life as a small business owner is your personal credit is always going to impact the business's ability to borrow money. So if you have credit issues in your past that need to be fixed or addressed, we need to deal with that first. So we can unpack the information we get from a bank as long as you get the clarity of what they're saying.
All right, 1-800-639-2211, our number if you have a question or a comment about small business loans, wondering how you can get one, or maybe you're a lender with some advice to share. Feel free to join our conversation today at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Charlotte now and take a call from Adora. Hi, Adora, go ahead.
Hi, I'm aware of a small salon in Winooski that caters to people with hair loss. And the woman there, who's fabulous, is wanting to retire and is having a hard time finding a buyer because of exactly what you're talking about. And I'm wondering if there are any resources in Vermont that help people or that help businesses find buyers who have a unique niche. The salon really is the only one in Vermont that caters to this population, and it's crucial for the people who use it. So I'm wondering if there's any kind of funding source or support for businesses that really need to exist in the state.
Huh. Interesting question. Deborah Badrio, why don't I throw that to you first?
Sure. Certainly, we've had businesses that have sold through the traditional business broker, and there are several. There are two or three that are top of my head, and if you just Google Vermont business brokers, they'll come up, who specialize in selling Vermont businesses. Unfortunately, the grant, you know, when people call us, it's one of the calls we get quite frequently, I need a grant for my small business. Grants are not for-profit businesses. They're for nonprofits. There are occasional situations in which grants do figure in. I've just been involved in this process 3 years post-Irene, where some money came from the federal government to be granted to businesses that were having still long-term economic impact from Irene. But that's a very rare situation. So you need to take the grant conversation off the table. That's not going to help you start a small business. When someone's buying a business, you really need – the bank is going to look at the cash flow of the business you're buying, the history of that business, what you as the potential buyer, what your credit picture looks like, what do you bring to the table? You can't walk into a bank with no investment in this project of your own. You need to have, as the bankers call it, skin in the game. They're not going to assume all of the risk themselves. So you need to be, you know, in that risk. So they take a lot of things, and they need to know that when you buy this business, which has not been carrying a debt load in going forward, you're now going to be borrowing money. So you now have a debt load. So not only does the business have to have a lot of room in the bottom line to be profitable. It now has to be profitable enough to pay you enough so that you can live and also so that you can pay the bank back. And that's sometimes what owners who are selling don't really consider, is that extra piece that the bank is now looking for. They need to get paid back.
I want to throw something that Deborah just mentioned, Will, to you. You're talking, she was just mentioning skin in the game. How much do you expect a borrower to throw in of their own money when they're seeking a loan?
We usually start the conversation looking for folks to have 20% of what we call the project cost. And that could be the purchase of the business or any additional asset and also working capital. You can't buy a business and start day one with $0 in the bank. So we really want to make sure that we have a scope of what the project is. We generally look for folks to have 20% of that. There are programs out there that we can back that down to 10% possibly. VITA has some programs available for that.
All right. 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number on Vermont Edition today. We're talking about what it takes to get a small business loan. Let's go back to the phone lines now and talk to Ben, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have a small business. We started about 3 years ago. We're in the software business, so there's really no tangible product per se, but we had a great idea. We did go through all the different agencies available to help you put your business together and your plans and whatnot. We had great credit rating. Unfortunately, you know, after going through months of this, we were still not able to raise the capital to do it. So, you know, basically went the route of short-term loan organizations, higher interest rates, mm-hmm. and credit cards, basically. And now we're, you know, over $1 million company, employ 9 people. And, you know, now, of course, the banks are all over us. We have to keep telling them to leave us alone. You know, so it's kind of a different model. So Vermont is not really geared for intellectual property-based organizations. They're more geared towards, you know, tangibles such as coffee roasting or something of that nature. But for people in the technology business, it's a struggle. So, you know, sometimes we have to go to, you know, venture capitalists outside of the state. And it's a shame because, you know, we like to keep everything in-house here locally.
Go ahead. Will, you wanted to comment on that.
I think, Ben, it sounds like the lenders you spoke with probably told you that you had a shortfall on collateral.
Collateral, yep.
And that is certainly something that any lender is going to look at when considering a commercial loan. There are programs to help with that, but again, collateral is a big piece of what any lender is going to look for on a commercial loan. And you're right, with intellectual property, it's very hard for us to consider collateral value on things like software products.
And one other thing, Deborah, I wanted to ask you. Ben brought up the fact that he used credit cards, and I would imagine that is something that a lot of prospective business owners end up doing. How big a risk is that?
It's a sizable risk. Congratulations, Ben, on having that turn out to be a spectacular risk. And, of course, that's what risk is. It's either great or it's horrible. You know, it's on that continuum. So, you know, what we find with a lot of first-time businesses, especially in Ben's case, and, you know, I hear his concern about the fact that, you know, tech businesses that don't have things that can be collateralized, those are the things that are hard pieces of property or building and some equipment. You know, traditional banking likes things that it can have if something goes wrong. So that's when we talk to people about collateralization. And ideas can't be collateralized in the beginning. So people do cobble together. We see people most often, frankly, in a new startup taking out home equity if they have it in their own home. So going and getting a home equity loan, getting money from friends and family. There are upsides and downsides to that. Pulling money out of their IRAs, pulling money, you know, doing the credit card thing. And what you have to be, and sometimes that risk is a doable risk if the business plan has the legs that it needs to have, if the market is truly there to receive the product. And you have people who have the acumen to run the business through that, you know, first part, which is a little risky, just on a day-to-day basis in starting a new business. So you have to always calculate the risk against the reward. And as we're fond of saying, we're not your mom, so we're not going to tell you you can't do it, but we're going to tell you the upsides and the downsides. Credit card money is extremely expensive. We will try to find other places. There are, you know, there are some other lenders, some alternative lenders in Vermont that will lend a little bit of working capital, not a lot, but some, higher interest rate than Will's going to be able to get, give them. But so you look at, you sort of list all the, you list all the possible places that money can come from. And at the end with us, we hope we have a very candid conversation about how you should move forward.
All right.
And okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
And hopefully, if the business does it the way you want it to do, there's a calculated plan for paying that debt back down and being in the clear, as Ben was saying, in a fairly, you know, for him, if it's a year, that's a really stunning and wonderful length of time that he can turn around and pay those credit cards off.
All right. Well, we'll take more of your comments and questions on small business loans today on Vermont Edition, and we'll also look at some alternative methods of funding after we take a short break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kenkin for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Some business owners feel banks aren't doing enough to invest in their communities with business loans, but banks point out they have to follow strict federal regulations. Today on Vermont Edition, we're talking about all of that and the best way for small business owners to access capital. My guests are Will Hamilton, a business lender with the Vermont Federal Credit Union, and Deborah Boudreaux. She's a business advisor for the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Listeners, you can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition webpage at vpr.net. Well, we've been talking about banks and credit unions, but a number of other organizations are also helping businesses harness money. There's the Vermont Community Loan Fund. They did a lot after Tropical Storm Irene. Another is Community Capital of Vermont, CCVT, which specializes in providing loans to business owners who lack the collateral or credit history to qualify for traditional bank loans. There's also the Vermont Economic Development Authority, VEDA for short. Steve Greenfield, VEDA's Chief Operating Officer, joins us by phone to talk about how they help private business capital, or provide, rather, business capital. Steve Greenfield, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Nina. I'm happy to be with you.
So explain how VEDA partners with other lenders to provide low-interest loans to businesses and farms in Vermont.
Well, that's a good question, Nina. And that's really what we are, is we're a partner with the lenders, banks, credit unions, and other sources of capital, too. You mentioned some of the Vermont Community Loan Fund and other so-called alternative lenders, and usually the borrower's own resources as well, to try to put together a package that makes sense for the lenders and makes sense for the borrower. It has to make sense in terms of being attractively priced financing and financing on terms and conditions that the borrower can accommodate with their cash flow. So we do work with all the banks around the state, some even out of state, all the credit unions and other local lenders to put together a financing package. VEDA really doesn't do 100% financing on projects. We're pretty much always in a transaction with other lending partners.
So if somebody comes to VEDA for a loan, should they expect to get some of the money from VEDA, but then also have to go to a credit union or a bank to get the rest of what they need?
Yes, they should expect to have to do that. And our percentages that we can finance vary. The norm is 40 to 50%. Occasionally a little bit higher. I would just point out, too, that there was an interesting commentary from, I think, a fellow named Ben, who had a tech business in Burlington. He was the credit card fellow who looks like he's done really quite well with that mode of financing. VEDA does have an entrepreneurial loan program that's designed to assist tech companies and other companies that are the budding stars of tomorrow, shall we say. And with that program, we can fund even a larger percentage of the project and take a little more risk on collateral than we would normally take. VEDA's in a position to take, and its mission is, to take a little more risk with respect to lending and collateral than banks or credit unions really can take.
So you've been operating, or VEDA rather, has been operating since the 1970s. And from your point of view, has it gotten harder for businesses in Vermont to access capital through banks and credit unions, or not?
Well, of course, over the 40, I haven't quite been here 40 years, but pretty close. It's been a fairly long span of time, and things have gone in cycles and continue to. There'll be sometimes a general tightening of credit and then a general loosening of credit kind of in relation to business cycles, or sometimes what happens, you know, on the federal scene when we had a big problem a few years ago, it was really caused not by Vermont banks who run their operations and credit unions very well, but by the major money center banks who engaged in some pretty questionable practices. But I would say right now that by and large, for businesses and projects that are feasible, there's probably enough loan capital available. For some of these businesses, loans aren't the answer because there's debt to service, as Deborah was saying earlier. But I think generally speaking, there's a respectable amount of capital available in Vermont. That said, not every business would agree with that or can get financing in Vermont because of sometimes the collateral requirements or their cash flow history.
And Steve, just briefly, who can apply for a loan through VITA?
Pretty much any legal small business or agricultural operation. We do a number of loans to the agricultural community, everything from dairy farms to maple sugaring to goat farms and so forth. So really, most any kind of large or small business can apply here. We have multiple programs, and usually somebody is eligible for one or more programs.
All right. Steve Greenfield is Chief Operating Officer for the Vermont Economic Development Authority. Steve, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Nina. Thank you.
So Kim from Johnson wrote in and with a question, Deborah, that I'd like to pose to you. She says, is there an online resource for investors to directly loan to small businesses that they're interested in? And if so, it would be a great way to boost the local economy.
The SBA has just come up with a new program where you can go in and go to the Vermont SBA website, which is, and you can actually put in some information. It's a kind of lender matchmaking program, and you can get some information back on the lenders who are lending in your arena who are open to this loan. So that's new and available. She could certainly try that. Coming to us and having a meeting and having a conversation. And if you're in business, you know, we always say start with the bank that you bank with. And if you're a small business owner, we suggest that you not bank at the drive-thru all the time. You want to go into the office and, you know, bank at the window, say hello to the lending officer that may have lent you the money to start your business. Just get to know those people because it's a long-term partnership in Vermont. And I have found, I've been doing this job 5 years now, that the local bankers try very hard to meet the needs of these of our businesses. And as Steve said, and Will has attested to, there are just some packages that don't work for a variety of reasons. But those are not reasons that are consistent. They are across the board. They don't describe a whole, you know, mental set of how we lend in Vermont. They're really very specific to each individual deal and what might be right with it or wrong with it. So I think it's hard to, when you've heard a no more than once, and sometimes you hear more than one, to stand back and say, wow, what's really wrong with my plan, rather than it's the banks that don't understand me. So I think it's just continuing to work really hard to figure out what you do need to do to change that plan. And sometimes we suggest to people that you wait another year, save a little bit more money, address this issue, you know, push the timeline out a little bit and, you know, take a moment and take a pause. So, and put that plan together in a way that does make it more attractive to commercial lenders.
Well, Hamilton, I wanted to ask you, one business owner I spoke to felt that banks weren't doing enough to invest in their communities, namely by offering more loans to local businesses. What do you say to that?
I'd have to disagree with that. I really feel that the smaller lenders out there do take the time. And we are in business to make loans. We don't want to say no to everybody. That said, obviously there are some people we have to say no, not now. But there are folks out there who I have worked with for maybe a year or more in getting prepared to get a small business loan. It's not an overnight process.
And it sounds like people have to be very tenacious when they're going after small business loans, because it sounds like, as we've talked today, you're going to blend loans with maybe some grants, with maybe some help from a small business organization. So you're kind of cobbling a lot of sources together oftentimes. Is that the case?
Yeah, and it's never too early to start the conversation. I know we mentioned earlier you might have somebody come into a bank and not be prepared. That's okay. people can come in and say, I'm thinking about starting this business or buying this business. What do you need? What do you look for in an application? And that way they will know, and any red flags or deal breakers we can bring up, the sooner the better.
And Deborah Boudreau, when you have somebody that needs cash for their business or wants to buy a business, is there a place that they can go to get a list of all of these organizations, some of which we've talked about today, to seek help, these organizations that provide funding?
Certainly. I mean, the Vermont, the Secretary of State's office does a great job of that. You know, Google is a wonderful thing. You can just type in. We have some resources on our website, vtsbdc.org. You know, you can always call the Vermont SBA. They come in and guarantee loans, but they're very aware of what lenders are lending and, you know, who's out there and what's happening. So there are a variety of sources. And, you know, I find Vermonters are tenacious, and the business owners who do get this, I think, have done a lot of incredibly hard work and have come up with plans that are really quite doable. And that's what success looks like at the end of that day.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Will Hamilton is with the Vermont Federal Credit Union. Deborah Boudreau is with the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Thank you both very much for spending so much time with us today.
Thank you, Nina. Good to be here.
Thank you, Nina. Thanks, Will.
Coming up, Vermont has been a trailblazer when it comes to fighting so-called patent trolling. Just ahead, we'll explain what the state has done, the legal battle that's ensued, and why so many other states and the nation are following Vermont's lead. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kacken for Jane Lindholm. In 2013, Vermont passed the country's first law against so-called patent trolling. Now, some of the patent holders allegedly doing that trolling are fighting back and suing the state. Eric Goldman is a professor of law and director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University. He blogs about internet law and intellectual property for Forbes, and he joins us now. Professor Goldman, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's remind listeners what patent trolling is and how someone might do it.
Well, patent trolling is the improper assertion of patents in order to obtain a financial benefit that is not commensurate with the patent rights that the person is asserting. That could be anywhere from claiming that you have patents that cover things that exceed the scope of the patent to just a serial enforcement of patent rights with the idea that if you ask enough people to pay you money, some of them will, and that's profitable in its own right. The fact that we don't have a single definition of patent trolling is part of the problem here, and I trust we'll talk about in a segment. In fact, we're not exactly sure where to draw the line between the improper assertion of patent rights and the legitimate enforcement.
But so these are people or companies that purchase a group of patents without really intending to use or develop a product, and instead they're targeting other businesses saying, hey, you're using our patents without our permission, and we're going to sue you if you don't pay up.
That's certainly one model of patent trolling, but there's a wide range of other behavior that might or might not be included. It could be someone who comes up with an idea that is kind of questionable whether it should be patented, is able to convince the patent office to give the patent, and then just goes around and starts asserting that patent, not really because they're hoping to advance society, but just hoping to get people to write them checks. That's a very different type of model of patent trolling, but it might be equally pernicious.
So is anyone keeping track of how much money this has cost companies in recent years?
There are some people who have done some estimates about the cost of over-assertion of patent rights. And as you can imagine, there's fierce debates in the literature about the validity of those statistics. But the numbers I've seen convince me that we're, as a society, paying billions of dollars, maybe many billions of dollars, to people who are asserting patent rights that probably aren't doing what society hoped they would be doing with those patents.
Huh. So Vermont was the first state in the nation to pass legislation to punish patent trolling back in 2013. What sort of impact has that law had?
Well, let's just clarify a little bit. So Vermont tried to regulate the process by which patent owners could assert their patent rights. It tried to divide the world into improper assertions and legitimate assertions. And it gave some factors that suggested this looks more like an improper assertion or this looks more like a proper assertion. The idea is that by forcing the people sending the letters to be more specific and more honest about what they're doing, we're more likely to see legitimate enforcements, and we can punish those who are over-asserting their rights or who are trying to cut corners and impose costs on the recipients of those letters. That particular model of attacking the over-assertion of patent rights has proven to be quite successful or quite popular in the legislatures. And so based on the Vermont model, over 24 other states have followed its lead and have passed some type of effort to regulate the sending of demand or assertion letters for patent rights.
And do those laws that have been passed vary much from state to state?
There's a lot of commonality between them, but there are small variations in just about every implementation in different states. And this is one of the problems of regulating patents at the state level. If someone wanted to do a national campaign to enforce their patent rights, they would have to research each and every law because there would be differences. Some would require more disclosure of specific things that other states wouldn't care about, or there may be other specific steps that a person has to take under a particular state's law. So the patchwork of legal obligations on the part of a patent owner across the nation does make it quite difficult for someone to do a national campaign.
Well, Congress is also tackling this issue. Do you expect federal laws soon to deal with patent trolling?
There's been some proposals in Congress to take over the function of regulating the over-assertion of patent rights. So instead of having at the state level all these different state laws that govern when you can send a patent letter, demand letter, and what it can say, Congress might pass a law saying, here's what you can do across the nation. That, to me, strikes me as relatively uncontroversial. It seems that if that were the only aspect of patent reform at issue, that would be likely to pass. But it's been bundled together with other efforts to do additional reforms to the patent system, and those have proven controversial. So it's a little bit unclear right now if Congress will enact regulation of patent assertions only because they might make it a package deal with everything else.
Right. Well, despite all of the other states following Vermont's lead, Vermont's now dealing with some pushback. MPHJ Technology Investments, that's the company that was at the heart of the state's original anti-trolling legislation, is fighting back and recently filed a federal lawsuit against Vermont. What do you know about this company, MPHJ Technology?
They're well known in our community, but I've not independently researched to validate exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. But they've obviously attracted a lot of attention because they've been one of the companies that's been focusing on sending out lots of letters to small businesses across the nation. And because of that, there's a lot of people who've gotten a letter from this group and who are confused whether or not they actually have to settle up.
Well, there's a lot of legalese even swirling around this counter lawsuit. Can you explain what MPHJ's counter lawsuit alleges and what do you make of it?
There's actually two different legal battles that this group is fighting with Vermont. One is over the enforcement action that the state attorneys general brought against the group. And then separately, the group's filed what I might call a preemptive lawsuit, saying that Vermont's statute regulating the sending of patent demand letters violated a variety of different laws, including a claim that it was violating the First Amendment. The letter, even if it's a business letter seeking money, is still a form of speech. And so the lawsuit claims that the Vermont regulation is effectively chilling their free speech.
Huh. Well, there was an article in Forbes a week or so ago that cautioned lawmakers to be careful when enacting new laws to fight patent trolls, saying it's not always so black and white. Is there a way to craft laws to better deal with that concern?
You know, it really isn't black and white. And I do think that that's one of the lessons we might take away from the two dozen states that have enacted laws regulating the assertion of patents, that because there's all these different flavors of what looks like a bad enforcement or a legitimate enforcement, it's clear we don't have consensus on that topic. Nevertheless, I think there is some value to trying to get patent owners to think carefully about what claims they're making before they send a letter, and to force them to do some of their homework before they send a letter. So in that sense, I think that even if we're going to be thoughtful about this, I think there's some merit to the effort. But the effort is only one piece of a much larger equation of regulating the overall problem of over-assertion of patent rights, and especially the over-assertion of not-so-great patents, or what we might call bogus patents. And there's a multi-pronged effort to combat that problem, which regulating the letters being sent is just a small piece of it.
All right. Professor Goldman, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Eric Goldman is a professor of law and director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University. He blogs about internet law and intellectual property for Forbes. The Purple Heart is a military honor given to service members who are wounded or killed while serving. But for various reasons, medals can become lost or separated from their recipients over time. A Vermont nonprofit, Purple Hearts Reunited, has been working to return lost medals to the descendants of their original recipients. Since 2012, the group has returned over 150 military artifacts to families and military halls of honor across the country. Recently, a Purple Heart was reunited with the family of Private First Class Cedric Laraway. VPR's Rick Singeri attended the ceremony.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The ceremony to return Private Laraway's Purple Heart to his family began with the Pledge of Allegiance at the Stowe Historical Society. Private Laraway was born in 1918, and the Stowe native enlisted in the Army in November 1943. He served with the 314th Regiment, 79th Infantry Division, in France. Hannah Doyle is with Purple Hearts Reunited, and she presided over the Laraway ceremony.
One of the neat things about this whole process is being able to fill in some of the gaps for the families at some times. You know, sometimes we don't know all the details of a veteran's life, and then we start digging in with the impetus of a lost medal, and we find out all kinds of things.
74-year-old Dorothy Wescombe came from Florida for the ceremony and composed a note for the occasion to honor her father's service.
Cedric Charles Laraway was my dad. He joined the Army to help defend our country. He left his family behind. That must have been difficult, to know he might not ever see them again. He was going to miss them and the things that children do. He was going to a totally new way of life, fighting in a war. It must have been a terrifying experience. Dad did his best, but that didn't save him. He died in action. He didn't come back home. No, he was lost. Lost in the battle, not to see his family ever again.
Broad-shouldered Timothy Hodette, a chief in the Vermont National Guard, somberly observed the ceremony.
There's something about a Purple Heart. You know, it's hard to describe. I always just tell the young guys in the units, don't go looking for a medal. It's not worth it.
Hodette served in the Vermont Guard with the founder of Purple Hearts Reunited, Zachariah Fike. Both men earned Purple Hearts while deployed in Afghanistan.
He was actually at the ceremony when I was awarded my Purple Heart. And I get to be at the ceremony when he was awarded his. I was actually blown up in a place in Afghanistan, over in Farah, Afghanistan. I suffered an injury on my head, and they gave me the Purple Heart. I wasn't looking for it, and it just, don't go looking for medals, best I can say, you know.
But once a medal is bestowed on a soldier, Purple Hearts Reunited wants to make sure it stays with his or her family. Hannah Doyle says the organization receives two or three medals a week that have been separated from the veterans who earn them. Veterans like Private First Class Laraway.
So, with no further ado, we want to get this back to your family as soon as possible. And we thank you for your service and your sacrifice, and we honor Cedric Laraway.
Thank you.
giving so much.
For VPR News, I'm Rick Sengary.
Purple Hearts Reunited was founded by Vermont Army National Guard Captain Zachariah Fike. We interviewed him in 2012 when he first began his work to return Purple Hearts to families of veterans. You can listen to that interview and learn more at vpr.net. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, we look at the work, life, and Vermont connections of author Shirley Jackson. A new generation of readers is rediscovering her work, from the psychological scares of the lottery and the haunting of Hill House to her recently republished memoirs of raising a family in Bennington. You can send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed today's program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.